Feels like it's been a while since we've done one of these, but I guess it's been 1 week.
It's only been 1 week, but it feels like it's been a very long week.
Yeah.
I did a bunch of OAuth things this week and a bunch of external flow things this week, which I wasn't looking forward to doing, but I got them out of the way. And
you redid like the entire onboarding flow for Design Collective, right?
Yeah, I did. I'm a lot happier with how it turns out. So before it was 5 steps. And this is my favorite reason for redoing the onboarding, was that when Scott and company were at stores, so basically he goes around to stores, and when they're ready to onboard, he'll visit with them and he'll sit with them and actually go through onboarding with them. And so the onboarding process used to be, step one was like the details that we need, you know, like they have to sign the marketplace agreement and all that stuff. They like enter their address and their store name. And then it goes like step two is, okay, well, here's how you add a product. And step three is like, okay, here's how you add products to sales, and step four and so on. Well, he was saying that pretty much everyone just wanted to skip all that. They just wanted to do step one and then like skip it and do it later on their own time.
They probably don't have all the paperwork and whatever. And it's a pain when you have somebody in your office working through something with you.
Yeah. So like step one stuff, they were fine with, like, cause part of step one is creating their own Stripe account. So we are using their Stripe Connect platform to do that. And it's pretty easy. They click a link on my site, then they go to Stripe and they create an account, and then it goes back to my site basically. But they didn't really want to sit and add a couple of products, or they didn't want to sit and like upload images and stuff. They want to do that later. Or for what I found out later was that a bunch of stores actually hired somebody else. So they'll find like some college kid in town that needs a job and be like, hey, we'll pay you to put stuff on the platform for us. Because I ended up having to provide support for a bunch of those people because they weren't necessarily technically savvy. And then they were just like, yeah, well, I just got hired to do this one thing, so I need to make sure, you know, it gets done. So they were hounding me. But anyhow, we simplified it just down to one step, which that was my favorite thing about it. It was that we didn't like, we knew for a fact that people were skipping it. So we're like, let's just remove it.
Yeah. And I mean, all that stuff is still there in the system, I assume. It's just not mandatory to go through first.
Correct. So now onboarding consists of, you would go to /join after you sign up and everything. And then that would create a store in the back end, and it would create like a Stripe customer in the back end and all that stuff. And then they would go through, and all that we really need is just the basic information, their contact info, their address. They got, you know, sign the agreement. So the marketplace agreement is actually in OAuth flow with DocuSign, which was the hardest part. And it was only hard because the documentation is really dense for DocuSign. But yeah, so they go through and create the Stripe account, sign the agreement with DocuSign. So, and
what is the DocuSign agreement doing? I'm not sure I caught
that bit. It's just our like terms and agreements and stuff like that. So
basically you actually require a legally authorized signature instead of just a checkbox?
Yeah. It's a legally binding thing. Yeah. And we talked about that way back when, and our lawyers for DK, or I guess that's what they are. I've never talked to them myself, but I talked to them third party through Lindsay. And they advised us heavily to not just use a checkbox, but actually have an agreement that someone would sign.
That's really interesting. Did they go into the rationale for that? Because I just feel like so many legally binding things on the internet happen with just checkbox.
Well, checkbox and a pop-up, right? Like, I agree. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't push back really on them because in my mind, I was like, well, I mean, there's lots of money changing hands and there's like sales tax and stuff. So, and there's commission happening sometimes, and other times there's not.
Right.
So, I was fine with it. And that way we have actual signed copies of contracts. And we're using DocuSign because how they have it set up, there's some things that they abide by so that it is a legally binding contract when it is signed. I haven't like read all the fine print on it. I just know that that's what they,
that's their whole job. Like, that's why DocuSign exists. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. And it works out pretty well. So, it's literally, they click, like the customer or our stores click a button and they go and it shows them the contract and they can read through it and then they can do a digital sign and then they can enter any other like required information. And then they click done and it gets sent off to Scott and goes into our DocuSign inbox and gets sent to them as well. And then they just get redirected back to my site. So they just land back on onboarding and it says, hey, thanks. You know, you signed successfully and stuff.
So another thing you were talking about recently, I think we were chatting about this, not on the show, just in a chat or whatever, but was email validation. Did you ever figure out what you were doing around that?
Oh, that's a whole thing. yeah, because we did talk about that.
Right. So basically, like, you need to do email validation, but
yes,
there's been some pushback around like how that flow works for your customers, the stores.
So the non-technical team, people on our team, and I think our customers in general, especially the store owners, because I don't want to say antiquated because that doesn't feel like a very nice thing to say about them. But
well, no, but they own a furniture store. They're not nerds.
Yeah, they're not programmers. Yeah. You know, they're not like they use a computer when they need to. You know, so a lot of the non-technical people, when any sort of thing happens, like so, even down to like a form validation error, like you forgot to put in the zip code for your address. It's like almost physically jarring to them, right? They're like, what happened? I don't understand why this didn't work. Is like the first kind of thing that goes through minds that I've noticed anyway.
Yeah. Why, hey, it's this is broken. Why is this broken?
Yeah.
It's never this says I did something wrong. I should probably do it differently.
Right. They don't read the red text. They just see that it's red. And then they're like, it doesn't work. Which that's like my biggest pet peeve is when someone like just says it doesn't work. I'm like, what do you mean? Are there any messages? Oh, the message here says that the zip code is missing. I'm like, okay.
Well, is there a zip code?
What's the zip code?
Next step.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But I mean, like, you know, that's just where their headspace is at. You know, that's, you know, they think that it should work the first time. And so if it doesn't, it's like physically jarring.
I think that was one of the most like jarring and surprising things for me as a developer, as I started doing more user testing and like looking at how people actually interact with technology, is like people don't get error messages at all.
It always boils down to it doesn't let me,
yeah,
or it did not work. So I always ask, what is it and what does did not work mean? Hopefully my mom doesn't mind me mentioning this, but like when she was really new to programming, she would see error messages and she would say to me via text or whatever, it doesn't work or it didn't let me do this. I'm like, I don't understand what it didn't let you do this means. That gives me 0% context of what's happening. Can you actually tell me what the error message is? And it's just, if you're not a programmer, I guess, or if you're not like a power user of the web, you just don't think that way. So really in your mind, it doesn't let you do something if that's what happened. If it didn't work, it didn't let you do something. So what we were finding was that as Scott would go over to stores when it was ready to onboard them, they would usually like sign up previously, they'd previously have created an account. And our flow is pretty standard. And especially since the Rails side of things uses Devise, there's a confirmable setting there, which requires that a user confirms an email address before they can sign in. This also blew my mind, but I couldn't believe the number of like misspelled email addresses and the number of people that just say like, oh, I never got the email, you know? So that was always a thing that I was feeling. Someone would reach out to me and say, hey, this email was never sent. And of course, I know that it 100% did send. So then I have to like weed through that. I'm like, okay, it did send. It was delivered. Here's a screenshot from Mailgun,
right,
saying that it was delivered. Have them check their spam. And so usually it's like you have to repeat that 4 or 5 times, have them check their spam before that actually happens. But again, circling back to the jarring thing, if they have to do that, then in their mind, something is broken, right?
Wait, well, wait, why is this my spam? This shouldn't, are you spamming me?
Amazon didn't go to my spam. Like, okay.
Amazon didn't even email me.
I hear that a lot too. Amazon. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't even, yeah, exactly. So, we're getting a lot of that. And then, you know, some people, like, I think especially Gmail, that people were getting their confirmation emails sent to the spam and stuff like that. So yeah, so we went around and around. They're like, can we just get rid of confirmations? And I was sticking my feet in the sand and be like, no, we need that to happen. Otherwise someone could sign up with Obama's email address and then we would think that, you know, it's Obama when it's not. So there's a reason why we need to validate that people own that stuff.
Well, and I mean, like you said, you were seeing a lot of even mistype emails.
Oh, yeah.
And if you don't do the confirmation step, then you're going to send them some important email at some point about their account or billing or whatever, and they're just not going to get it. And then you're in real trouble. Like you have to make sure you have the right email.
Yeah, so I ended up talking to you about it because I was like, well, it is a thing because it does affect how people perceive, especially the store owners, because we want them to be confident that things are working well. And even though it's not like a message going to their spam isn't what they think it is, we still need them to they still perceive it as being broken or something being wrong, right? Something needs to be quote unquote fixed, right?
Yeah, you need to give the appearance of something that is seamless, even if there are a bunch of seams.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I talked to you about it, and I was like, "Well, how are you handling it?" If I remember this correctly, you're just saying that you don't require email to be confirmed to log in. You just require it to be confirmed before they perform certain actions, like update their settings.
Yeah. So basically, my biggest worry is kind of like you said, somebody signs up with ObamaWhiteHouse.gov because he is our president, I think, right? Anyhow, somebody signs up with that email address, and then they send out invitations. It's going to say ObamaWhiteHouse.gov invited you to Nest Notes. And I mean, that's obviously that's not ideal. So we need to confirm. 100%. We need to confirm that identity before we can allow people to send out invitations. That's a big one. There's a couple other things that are blocked off too. But basically, yeah, I just have a flag on my users until they confirm that just says it's like email confirmed or something like that. It's just a Boolean.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to your settings page before that or try to do any of these actions, it'll just say, "Hey, your email hasn't been confirmed yet. Do you want us to resend that email?" And then they have the option to do that until they confirm. But you can still like log in and use the app, the features that aren't affected by this. It's just we need to cut some things off.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what, so I ended up having a talk with the team, and I was just kind of outlining why we just need to, like, at some point require that they can confirm that they own the email address. And it was fine. Everyone was like, "Oh yeah, like I would never have thought about someone using someone else's email address and like masquerading." And the big thing was that we're working on building out a lot of a few real-time features and a bunch of more social type features. And that was where I was like, okay, so before anyone has the ability to do any sort of thing that another public member of the site could see, that's when we need to require that they can verify that identity.
Right. Yeah. The proof of identity before you validate it to other people. Is the big thing.
Yes,
like you don't want to misrepresent someone based on their lie.
Yes, exactly. And they were 100% on board with that. They're like, "I get it. It makes sense. Let's do it." So what I've done for now, and it's kind of weird because we're still in that transitional period where Elixir is moving on really well. And I have at the end of the month, it's September now. At the end of the month, we should be going live with it. So what I did was I just turned off the confirmable feature, or I didn't turn it off. I extended. There's a time period setting where you can allow people to log in before they are required to confirm it. And I just set it to a year for now.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Hey, these people wanted to hear how the sausage gets made, and that's how it's happening.
Yeah.
So yeah, I set it to a year or something so people can sign up and do all that stuff. And we don't have a ton of social stuff on it right now, or we do, but it's not really exposed much. So I figured it was a pretty okay middle ground for solving that problem. But yeah, it was a whole thing that I'd never really thought about. Like, I just knew that that was what you were supposed to do. Like, that's what you're supposed to do. You have people confirm their email address before they can use your thing. And I don't know, it's really good for me to be around non-technical people because I always learn so much from them. About the way that they expect things to work, and about the way, even if they have an idea of how like Amazon works, and that's not necessarily true, that's still how they think it works, if that makes sense. So again, it's kind of like holding their hand and giving them the perception of a seamless experience when really there's seams. It's like, okay, how well can we smooth over these seams so they don't notice them?
The thing to me about the email confirmation and using something like Device for auth in general, I for anybody who's worked with me, you probably know I'm not a huge fan of auth libraries like that, or auth engines, or whatever you want to call them. This is kind of gets to the root of why, for me, at least a big part of why, is this whole thing around email confirmations, because it's not. I don't see any of that stuff as a one size fits all sort of thing. A lot of people are like, "Oh, it's just auth, it's just email confirmation, just whatever, just use something out of the box." But the fact of the matter is, at least in my opinion, that's something that needs to be pretty customized for a lot of apps. I've worked on some apps where it really doesn't matter that much, and I've worked on other apps where it's really important. And with Nest Notes, like I'm saying, certain parts of it, it's very important to have that confirmation. Certain parts, it doesn't really matter at all. There's no real reason or need for it to be an immediate sort of thing. And when you use an engine that is designed to be inherently designed to be generic, you can't account for your own business needs, at least not always as easily.
It makes it a lot harder.
Or it can. And it certainly those types of libraries can make things much easier, and a lot of people use and love them. But I think I think there is sort of a pressure in development to like always use those sorts of tools when in reality it might not always be the best answer or might not be appropriate.
Yeah. Well, I hear a lot of people saying that they use things like Devise because of security implications, and that's fine. You know, I don't think that Devise is anything too crazy that you couldn't do on your own without being informed. I think the big thing is that you have to be informed of how to circumnavigate some of that security stuff. And I mean, in Rails case, there's HashSecure password. So there, that's like half part of it handled. You know what I mean? And I think some of the benefits that you get from Devise would be like locking accounts and stuff like that. But like you said, it comes with a trade-off of you get some stuff for free, but then there's a lot of other stuff that might take longer than it normally would. And context-wise, there's way more context surrounding that authentication problem than would be if you had the custom solution for it. So I always see posts where people are trying to do, they have like a very specific use case on a forum and they're stuck. You know, there's just not really much they can do because they opted in for a big auth library like that, like you said.
Yeah, and just I hate the feeling more than just about anything else of being hamstrung by the tools I'm using. Like that's never a good spot to be in. So especially with something as fundamental as like auth and user logic, something where at least I think there can be a lot of use cases for doing things a little bit differently now and again. This email confirmation stuff I think is a great example of this, where it's just not mm-hmm. it's not a one size fits all thing. It's not like you have to sign up and then confirm your email before you can do literally anything. That just doesn't apply to most apps. And if you treat it like that, if you just use a library out of the box, then you might not even think about this, right? You just do it and then it's done. And I mean, I've been in the same boat before where it's like, oh, I'll just use a solution and then it works, whatever, for the basic use case. But I don't actually think through what my specific goals are and like what kind of things I want to do custom.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just something I try to be very, very mindful of when choosing libraries.
Yeah, again, it's like the trade-off between got to get to market and use all the libraries we can versus, okay, now we're in the market and we need to actually make changes because now we have real feedback, you know? I always find it's interesting. It's kind of like I was having another meeting with the DK folks and we were talking about the rebuild and all that stuff. And I think the analogy that I use is like, okay, so the MVP was like a house that we bought that was prefabricated, you know, like we had a bunch of requirements that we knew that we needed to satisfy and the house looked pretty okay. So that's what we were living in the house. And now that we've lived there for a while, we've knocked down a couple of walls and like added a porch onto the back, you know, and changed the house. And while it gets the job done, it's not quite the same as having a completely custom built house, if that makes sense.
Sure. Designed from the ground up for exactly your wants and needs. And I think exactly.
And so that's what,
I think what you said about the I'm launched and now I have real feedback thing is so, so important. And obviously a lot of people have touched on this and we've touched on this in the past, I'm sure. But launching quickly and getting real user feedback is so critical because you get so close to these projects. You get really, it's so easy to become absorbed into it to where you can't even really see what you're supposed to be building anymore. And sometimes you need that external feedback from other people to be like, oh yeah, I hadn't even really thought through this portion of my onboarding flow. Or because you do that, you know, you set up your onboarding flow probably pretty early on in a lot of projects. And then you just move on because you have other features to work on. But then getting that, like you said, real feedback from actual people who don't have any vested interest in the project is so important to do early. And it can be tough, but it's valuable.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess it's all about finding that middle ground, right? Like not getting hamstrung by your tools, but also finding something that's reliable enough or flexible enough that it can ebb and flow with what you're doing. And I think that there's time and places that you'd want to choose the tool over choosing doing it yourself. But more often than not, and maybe now this is because I have more experience, more often than not, I'm opting these days to build the MVP code that I need for it to work as opposed to inheriting something that's much, much larger. So for example, when I first did the onboarding for Rails, I used a bunch of different OAuth gems. Like I used one for Stripe and I used one for some other stuff. And this time around, all I did was I made a couple of modules and I wrote a bunch of Elixir functions and it works. And there's no buried code because there's no dependencies there, you know?
Right. There's no magic. There can't be because everything is just right there.
Yeah, application code. Yeah, it's right there. All the routes are right there, plain as day. If you want to see what happens, you go to it, and then it takes you to the controller. The controller uses module functions. There's no logic in any of the controllers. It works great. It's just functions, you know? And I think part of that is due because I did it the first time, so now I understand how like the OAuth standard and flow kind of should work and how it should be built. But the first time around, it was much more difficult because instead of just using the OAuth standard or like understanding that, I had to understand documentation for different gems, and you know, different people write things differently and different gems function differently. And so that was the confusing part, was kind of navigating the forest that comes along with choosing that campsite, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, OAuth, to be totally fair, is pretty intimidating at first.
Yeah,
I still have trouble wrapping my head around it sometimes. It can be pretty confusing. But at the end of the day, it's also just passing around some URLs, really.
Yeah, really. Like, I don't know why it was so difficult for me to wrap my head around. Because that's all that's happening. You land on my page, I generate a URL, you click on it, you go to that page sends you back to my page with some parameters in the URL, and that's it.
Yep.
It's done, you know? What's so funny is that it seems it's so hard to distill things down like that unless you've done something a few times.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because you say that, I mean, what you just said to me and to anybody listening to this podcast that understands OAuth, like, that makes sense. It, of course, yeah, that's how OAuth works.
Yeah.
But if you say that, like, nobody outside of people who already know how OAuth works, that description is not going to make any sense.
Right.
Or who already have, like, a pretty good understanding of how the web works and how sites pass information back and forth to each other and all that kind of stuff. Like, there's so much prerequisite knowledge to describing any of this.
Yeah, there is. I think even the first time I would have said, if you would have asked me how it works, I would have said, well, you come to my page and then I use a gem that generates a URL. You go somewhere else and you come back and the gem does a bunch of things. And then I just used the response from that. When really all the gem was doing was parsing, I mean, what the other site sent to it in the callback. So all it did was abstract one layer away. I know, you know, because I haven't done like Twitter and Facebook and like logins in a while, but I know that the responses were quite a bit different. And so you kind of have to deal with what the other side gives you. You don't really have a choice.
I mean,
you just get
even
it.
That's not so bad. I'm doing a lot of manual stuff with Facebook for Nest Notes. And it's again, one of those things where it looks really intimidating until you understand it. And then it's just URLs.
Exactly. Yeah.
Everything's just URLs, man.
Exactly. I remember being so confused the first time I did it. I was like, why is Twitter giving me this? And Facebook, I don't get it. Shouldn't it be the same? I don't understand what's going on. I was super confused by it. But anyhow, yeah, like I chose to not use anything extra for it. For Elixir, I'm using a gem called Stripity Stripe, and that's just I'm not using a gem. I'm using a mixed package in Elixir, and that just gives me some wrappers around the Stripe API. And so I use that a little bit, but the actual OAuth in Stripe Connect Flow is just some functions.
Yeah, and I mean, I hope people don't take any of this as me or either of us saying, oh, never use any libraries or API wrappers or anything, because there is certainly a lot of value to many of these tools, but I would just caution people against always saying like, oh, I'm gonna look for a gem and use a gem to do this thing whenever they encounter a problem, or use a mix package,
it's basically just a Halloween sack full of candy from strangers. That's what it is.
But I would say that people shouldn't jump either way on this. That sometimes it can be very, very beneficial to use these tools, and sometimes it's really not worth the extra hassle and all the dependencies and worrying about things updating and breaking. Whereas if you're directly talking to somebody's OAuth flow, then that's, first of all, probably not going to change, let's be honest. But secondly, if it does, then you only have to talk to the one person. You don't have to wait for a library update. You don't have to like, oh, well, is this still maintained? I'm going to have to submit a pull request against this library that hasn't been updated in a year and a half. Whereas if it's just your code, it's just your code. You just change it and you talk to the one person who is the, whoever is the provider of that OAuth flow, which to me, it has a lot of benefits.
I'm just thinking about candy now.
They brought back crispy M&Ms.
That's maybe the perfect metaphor for using open source packages. You get handed a sack full of Halloween candy from strangers.
Yeah, it might be good. Or there might be razor blades
in it.